welcome to Small Town Mysteries, where we talk about shit that went down in these small towns, shit that's unsolved, and shit that led to more shit. Except none of these stories actually involve shit so far. And I can still say that, at least with mine for this week. I'm Kate, here with Christine.
Hello.
And Rachel.
Hello.
Bringing you our 9th episode. We are at episode 9. I think the average podcast only runs for like 7 episodes. So we're crushing it.
We're cruising right along.
Yeah, we're doing great. And so I'm back. I took last week off for a little R&R post-bar exam, which my two co-hosts graciously allowed me to do. And I listened to their episode and they did a wonderful job in my absence.
You really missed out.
Yeah, I was so excited to listen to it, and there was some crazy stuff in there. But I'm going to dive into my case now, if that's okay with you guys. And I don't have this in my script, but I do want to start with a Massachusetts lingo session. Okay. I know you guys are both from Massachusetts, but based on the data on our listeners, not everyone's from Massachusetts. We have quite a few from out of the state and also out of New England and out of the country, which is remarkable. And I highly, highly appreciate everyone who's taken the chance to listen to our podcast. Just amazing that we have people from all around the world that care enough about what we're saying to listen to it. So I want to give you a little lingo lesson because I'm talking about Cape Cod today. So what I really, really need to emphasize is when you are from Massachusetts and you go to Cape Cod for vacation, you are down the Cape. You are not on the Cape. You are not in Cape Cod. You are not on Cape Cod. You are down the Cape. So I just want to throw that out there that this might be a dialect thing. Like maybe you've heard of Cape Cod and you're listening to this and I'm going to say something about, yeah, and down the Cape. And you're going to be like, I don't know. Wouldn't it be like on Cape Cod? No, it's down the Cape. So now I can get into it now. I just want to get that out of the way. I don't know if I actually say that exact phrasing in this segment, but that's really important for me to like get that out there out front. Like it's down the Cape. Okay. And if you say it differently, it's like mispronouncing Worcester. Everyone's going to laugh at you. So just wanted to throw that in there. So I just got back from my post-bar exam vacation, like literally 2 hours ago. So I decided there was no better case to cover than one from the area I stayed in. So buckle up. This one has a lot going on. I am covering the serial killer, Tony Costa, also known as the Cape Cod cannibal, also known as the Cape Cod vampire, and also known as Tony Chop Chop, as Rachel reminded me. I don't want to like disregard the severity of this man's crimes, but Tony Chop Chop is a really, really good nickname. So this is Tony Chop Chop.
The thing is, I've listened to so much true crime and I actually remember like who that is because of the name. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It sticks in your memory because of it. I mean, the Cape Cod vampire. Yeah. And also I was trying to look up specifically like Cape Cod cases. And when you type in like Cape Cod true crime or cases around Cape Cod, he's like the only person that comes up.
Wow.
Really?
And that's not to say that there isn't other stuff that happens on the Cape. It's just to say that there's an oversaturation of this particular case in Cape Cod lore. Yeah, so I'll get into a little bit actually about why this case in particular, because at first I thought it was too oversaturated to cover. Like it would be a case that people would like know already or whatnot. But I'm going to get into a little bit about the area where it took place and how it echoed to today, if that makes sense. And I'll get into why I chose it, because there's a lot going on with this one that still reverberates through the Cape. Tony Costa was a serial killer who killed multiple women in 1969. He was only 25 years old, which I'm just throwing that out there. We are all 25 years old.
Yeah, officially now.
Officially, all of us are 25 years old because my birthday was last week. So we're elderly and we're also the same age as this guy was when he committed many murders.
Kate, you literally got mistaken for a child.
Oh, this was the best.
Oh, no, wait. Let's tell the story. Okay, so we were in Maine and we went to Palace Playland, which is the amusement park at Old Orchard Beach. And was it the three of us in the car? It was. And Matt.
It was not me in the car, but I heard about it and I was...
Yeah, so the three of us were in the car and there was a pub crawl happening the same day near the park. So we were looking for parking, and this parking lot was usually $20. And the guy said, but for the pub crawl, I charge 30 and the extra $10 goes to whatever the pub crawl was.
I'm pretty sure it was ALS.
Yeah, ALS. And I was like, oh yeah, that sounds like really cool. So I'm sitting in the back seat. I had a tie-dye crop top on and overalls with a yellow fanny pack. And I think I had like a bucket hat on too. I was not dressing my age. I want to throw that out there. And the guy said, so yeah, so I charge people who are coming for the pub crawl 30. And then he said, oh, sorry, I didn't see the kid in your back seat. Just 20 for you guys. And I was the only person sitting in the back seat. So I saved us $10. I just want to like throw that out there.
I was jealous that you guys saved money, to be honest.
Yeah, because you guys paid full price because you guys all look like adults.
Yeah, sadly.
I have no idea how me and Matt were able to keep it together.
We were all fully like out of the car like a full 10 minutes later before I was like, so did that guy think I was a kid? Like, we didn't say it like right away. Like, it was like, no, wait a minute. And it's like even funnier because that trip was to celebrate graduating law school for me specifically. And I got mistaken for an actual child by the parking attendant. It's fine. Like I said, we saved $10.
The thing is, I think you could argue that we are children because we went on the bumper cars 5 times.
We went on the bumper cars like 9 times. It was more than 5 times. Well, the thing is that there was never a line for the bumper cars, and it's always fun. And we were all so sore the next day.
Yeah.
Because well, we have some very – okay, shush your mouth. We have some very competitive individuals in our group. I'm not looking at anybody specifically. Christine.
Okay, I didn't even play the last time, okay?
Because you hurt your neck.
But anyway, well, back to the case.
So anyway, he was only 25 years old, and then also 4 years after he was convicted, he committed suicide in prison. So that's very much the bare bones of that case. So baseline, Tony Costa was suspected. This is completely before any of the cases that I'm covering. Tony Costa was suspected of the murders of 16 women on the West Coast.
Really?
That's
a lot.
Shit!
Try though I might, I could not find a ton of info on any of that. So I don't know if that was like after he was convicted of these murders, someone went back and connected the dots, or if there was ever actually an investigation into him. But the fact of the matter is he was born in Massachusetts, lived out west for a while, moved to the Cape in the late 60s. So even before he committed a bunch of crimes here, he was suspected of committing a whole bunch of other crimes. So this guy has a really bad reputation, but at that point, no charges against him. He moved to Truro, Massachusetts, which is, say it with me, down the Cape. Thank you.
Here I see on the Cape.
I wrte on the Cape, but it's not.
Gasp.
Are you even from Massachusetts?
It's like when a teacher gets caught with like a spelling error or something, and then you're like, you spelled this wrong.
Anyway.
You got it.
He moved to Truro, down the Cape, sometime in the late 60s. So for context, there are about 2,000 year-round residents in Truro, but the summer population is between 15,000 and 20,000. So huge difference. Yeah. So like during the summer, you can barely walk down the street without physically running into people, but it kind of is like a ghost town in the winter. I don't know if any of you guys watch American Horror Story. The most recent season, Red Tide, or the first half of the season, took place in Provincetown, and it was kind of like that same idea of like it's packed during the season and then off season it's literally a ghost town.
Yeah,
that's a really accurate representation of the Cape off season. So very much a small town depending on the time of year. So there are 8 women that Tony Costa was suspected of murdering in Truro and the surrounding areas. They are named Diane Fedoroff, Christine Gallant, Sydney Monson, Barbara Spaulding, Susan Perry, Patricia Walsh, Bonnie Williams, and Mary Ann Wysocki. He was charged with 4 of these murders, but only convicted of 2, those of Patricia Walsh and Mary Ann Wysocki. In the course of the investigation, police also found the body of Susan Perry, but he was not charged with that murder. Interestingly, three of the women he was suspected of killing actually turned up alive later. So Diane Fedoroff, Bonnie Williams, and Barbara Spalding were eventually located alive and well. So I think that's a really good example of the importance of distinguishing between someone who's suspected of something and someone who's charged with something, because these women were alive and were presumably missing if they were suspected to be dead. But this man ostensibly had nothing to do with any of their disappearances, and they all turned up alive. So just an interesting aside. So the court of public opinion, if according to the internet, is like, yep, these women, they're going to be his victims. And then they were alive the whole time. So just
I really want to know more about that, because depending on how long they were missing and they were just found alive and well, that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and I'll get into it a little bit more about some of the connections these women had with Tony Costa. And I'm thinking it's entirely possible that he did have connections or relationships with them that other people knew about. So when kind of stuff came out against them and maybe these other women hadn't been seen recently, they kind of assumed it was him. But imagine the amount of relief for those families. That must have been insane. Okay, so here's where it gets a little bizarre. Tony Costa was a writer. And he wrote a novel called Resurrection while he was in prison. It was not published. And in this book, he detailed the murders of two women. And he claims that he and his friend Corey, one source says Carl. So I get into that a little bit later, that some say Corey, some say Carl, but I think they're meant to be the same person. So Corey / Carl. And then the two women who were murdered in this particular passage, they consumed LSD, and then Corey / Carl shot the two women. Tony claims that he then subdued Corey and helped him bury the bodies. So the veracity of this account is completely unverified, because the two women referenced in the novel are named Marianne Wysocki and Patricia Walsh. So it's pretty clear that he's talking about two of the victims, the two he was eventually convicted for killing. But his description of them being shot and buried is a lot more straightforward than what the investigators actually found. So I have some quotes from the prosecutor in this case that I think are really important to showing kind of what kind of scene investigators encountered when they found these bodies. So his name was Edward Dennis, the prosecutor, and he was quoted as saying that the hearts of each girl had been removed from their bodies.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so to me, that's pretty different from my friend shot two women when we hid the bodies. But
yeah, I would say so.
He also said, quote, the bodies were cut into as many parts as there are joints in the body. So this is a pretty stark difference between what Tony's account said. So I just want to put that out there again, that even though he did write an account of these two murders, and they happen to be the two murders he was convicted of, his account really varies substantially from the actual autopsies and everything, because they found teeth marks on the body. Like,
yeah, the actual like hard evidence.
Yeah, the actual hard evidence does not quite match up with what he said. So Tony does indicate in his novel that he ended the suffering, quote, of Marianne Wysocki by stabbing her. So he admits at least to that much involvement in the actual murders. But he also describes them as senseless. So I actually read part of his book. A newspaper article that had an excerpt of his book. It was never published, but a lot of it was publicly available as a part of other, like, investigative novels on these cases. He very much distances himself from these murders in his account. He calls them senseless, which I think is a very completely contrary description to cutting the bodies into tiny pieces to cover up what happened. Just once again, the veracity of his account, deeply questionable. He also tangentially claims that Susan Perry and Sidney Monson overdosed on drugs, and I'll touch back on that in a second, because those are two other women whose bodies were found. So as I said earlier, Tony Costa was a writer, and oddly enough, he corresponded with one particularly well-known writer while he was in prison, Kurt Vonnegut.
Okay.
Slaughterhouse Five, wow. that Kurt Vonnegut. So Tony's murders were a big news story, both locally and nationally. So it's not surprising that Vonnegut would know about them, especially because Vonnegut lived on the Cape at the time. So, yeah, he's local. You know, it comes up. But famously, Vonnegut commented on the case quite a few times, and he compared the murders committed by Tony Costa to those committed by Jack the Ripper, which I think is pretty damning.
That is.
He also has a really interesting quote from his correspondence with Tony, sort of his take on Tony's state of mind and like how much he actually could have been involved with this. So Vonnegut was quoted as saying, "The message of his letters to me was that a person as intent on being virtuous as he was could not have possibly hurt a fly." And he believed it. So this goes back to the Carl Corey thing, where there's this friend who's written about in the novel who seems to not exist. And the investigators mm-hmm. never identified if this person was a real person. And his defense in court was that it wasn't him, that it was this other man. The important thing here being that Kurt Vonnegut thinks that he legitimately thought he was innocent.
Hmm.
Again, I'm not 100% sure if I'm remembering this correctly, but for some reason, I feel like I am. He did know somebody named Corey. Like, there is actually, okay. You can actually find that name, but the thing is, he was not related to it at all. And they figured that out. I think it's, I'm sure you're going to get into more about this, but I feel like this is a perfect example of, I can't say the word, compartmentalism. Yeah, so like, you have like separate identities and you can kind of just like push that one back and be like, I'm here now. And then you just completely disassociate to the other one.
Right. Well, yeah. So I didn't dive into it because I wanted to keep this from being like an hour long on its own, but it does sound to me non-expert, like dissociative identity disorder, which used to be colloquially known as multiple personality disorder. That would track with him legitimately not thinking he committed any of these crimes, but it was his body who committed the crimes nonetheless. But it wasn't his conscience. I wrote about the first person to be found not guilty using dissociative identity disorder as his defense. And it was like a solid 10 years after this case. So obviously it didn't work for him, but that does seem to be what his claim was.
I feel like I've heard in other cases that it's like a coping mechanism. Like it's so that they can actually like live with themselves.
Yeah, but it's like, so what I've seen is that at the moment, like I'm, like I said, once again, not an expert, so please don't cite me. But it's that the conscience fractures at the time of trauma. So like there's a version of you that experienced it and then the version of you that didn't experience it.
Which I feel like makes so much sense because
I think it tracks. I just also think the psychology wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote in his novel that the two women who died via drug overdose were dismembered and buried by this alter ego, Corey. But he has no memory of doing that. So I don't know. It's a little muddled. But what's clear is that this man clearly thought that whether it was himself as another person or a completely different, still unidentified person, he didn't commit these crimes. Like, Tony Costa did not commit these crimes. It's completely outside of his conscience. And according to Kurt Vonnegut, that was a sincere belief that he held. Kurt Vonnegut thought, from the way he wrote about the case, that he legitimately thought he had not done it. I don't know. Kurt Vonnegut's not an expert either, but he seemed to think he was pretty sincere.
Mm. I don't want to say anything horrible about mental illness because obviously it is a real thing, 100%. But look at killers like BTK and Ted Bundy. Like, everybody said they were great people. So do you really ever know somebody?
Yeah. I think the only reason I would take Vonnegut at his word is that they corresponded after he was already in prison.
He probably had a mental illness. Like, I feel like I've said this, but I feel like in order to be a serial killer, you have to have some sort of mental illness.
For sure.
Because a normal person doesn't do that.
Right. It also doesn't mean that everyone who has a mental illness is a serial killer. But
yeah,
I agree with that there's something in the wiring of the brain that's different.
I don't know. I have a hard time with, like, the serial killers and claiming, like, multiple personalities or dissociative identity disorder, because it's you still did it.
Like, I know. I can't remember the name of the case off the top of my head that I researched for that other job that I had, but I'll send it to you.
I'd be very interested to read that.
It is an interesting topic, and there's a lot of debate, both in the true crime community and the psychology community and the legal community, about whether or not that's a viable defense. So I tried not to get into that because I didn't want to make this longer than it needed to be, and look at us, we got into it anyway.
It's hard. You can't just bring up some kind of mental health thing and like just sprinkle it in there, because we're just going to jump on that.
There's no touch of discussion of mental illness. It's you got to dive in. To wrap up, I want to pivot to some of the books that have been written about these murders. So some of them were more recent, some were contemporary to when the crimes took place. So aside from Tony's own novel, of course, notable ones are In His Garden by Leo Damore, which contains the excerpts from Tony's novel. That's how I read it. When that book came out, the newspapers published excerpts from Tony's novel that were included in Leo's book. It was an investigative book. And there's also a book called Tough Guys Don't Dance by Norman Mailer, which I didn't have a chance to look into, but obviously sounds interesting. But what I did glean from descriptions of that is that it seemed like a basis for some of the crimes, but not like the book's not about it. It's just that some of the crimes in that book are pretty similar to what Tony Costa was convicted of. What really I found interesting was the book The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer by Liza Rodman. And that book came out in 2021. So Liza's babysitter for a few summers, including the summer before the murders occurred, was quite literally Tony Costa. So according to her, Tony was charismatic. He was friendly. He worked as a handyman at the local motel that her mother also worked at. And he often took Liza and her sister to his secret garden. I feel like you know where I'm going to go with this. The secret garden was an actual garden in the woods of Truro, where he grew marijuana and, grossly enough, where he buried the bodies of the woman he killed.
Yikes.
Yeah, so this woman in her later years didn't connect the pieces of her babysitter, Tony Costa, who used to take her to this cool garden in the woods, and the serial killer, Tony Costa, whose bodies were found in the woods. Yeah, and so it's like half investigative novel, like investigative nonfiction, and half memoir. It's on my to-be-read list because I can't even fathom.
Yeah.
So I want to read that. I literally, it's on Goodreads on my to-be-read list because I want to dig into that a little bit. I just can't imagine. But she said I didn't reconcile the fact that it could be the same person until I was much, much older. Ugh. And I'm like, that is traumatizing.
That's nuts.
And more recently, just this past July, it came out literally 3 weeks ago, Casey Sherman wrote a book called Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod, in an attempt to bring some legitimacy back to the case that he claimed had been joked about too much in the 50 years since it happened. He did specifically cite the nickname Tony Chop Chop, so I don't fault anyone for using that nickname. I'm just saying you might have inspired him to write this book. Rachel in particular inspired him. So he specifically talks about other huge events that happened around the same time that might have overshadowed these murders. So he talks about like the moon landing, the Vietnam conflict, Ted Kennedy and what happened in Chappaquiddick, the Manson cult. These were all like astronomically huge events that happened in that same couple of year span as these murders. So in that regard, it kind of makes sense that these were known locally, not exactly known further than that, kind of joked about because they weren't those big, huge, massive news stories that these other things were.
I feel like it's important to note that the internet also wasn't around during that time, because I feel like it's easier for information to get to different parts of the country because the internet has everything. But it was different in the 70s.
Yeah, at that time it would be like frontline newspaper, all of those massive events that you just listed. Whereas the internet nowadays, I feel like you can go to so many different avenues and get so much information in such a short span of time.
Right. I feel like this case might have gotten like a blurb on the front page. Mm-hmm. Definitely not like headline material. That's not to say it wasn't a huge case where it happened, but more so that nationally it wouldn't have been as well known. So it did kind of get that reputation, like Tony Chop Chop, and, you know, like people making jokes about it. What's important to note is that Tony Costa's family still lives down the Cape.
Ooh.
And reporters have asked them recently about how they feel about the new books coming out. So there's some interesting comments from Tony's ex-wife. Her name is Avis Johnson. So Avis Johnson was quoted as saying that she was disgusted that this book was being written in 2022. And another family member named Peter Cook, and I couldn't find any info on how he was related, like if he was like a grandson or like exactly how he was related. But family member named Peter Cook said, "It's a sad thing to dredge up the name and story of Tony Costa when his wife, children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren all still live in this area." He says that such matters should be tossed into God's great sea of forgetfulness.
Well, I'm sorry, but he murdered multiple people in brutal ways. Right? And you can't just forget about that shit. I'm sorry.
Yep, I agree. I agree. But what interested me the most was that in 2002, there was a newspaper article written about these cases, and Costa's ex-wife, Avis Johnson, was asked again how she felt about it. At that point, would have been like 30-ish years after they took place. And she was quoted as saying that she had a deep concern about murder cases that were being sensationalized in a way that focused on the killers and let the memories of the victims fall by the wayside. And Sherman, who wrote the 2022 book, said that Avis Johnson and this quote in particular were a really big driving force behind his decision to research the case and write about it. So
yeah,
really, really, really interesting to me that in 2002, she said, like, this shouldn't be sensationalized, etc. And he was like, you know, she's right. We should talk about the victims. And he wrote this book. And then when she was asked about it, she said she was disgusted. I would be really interested to know if she's disgusted because of the focus on him or disgusted because she doesn't think it's victim focused enough, because that seems like a pretty substantial like change of opinion. I know a lot can change in 20 years, but it would seem odd to me for her to go from "we need to talk about the victims and not talk about the killer, even though it was my ex-husband," to "it's disgusting to talk about it at all." So just thought those quotes were a little interesting, a little tough to reconcile in the mind. Mm-hmm. So I want to say that as a closing, that his family is definitely still around and active on the Cape, because both Liza Rodman and Casey Sherman had to cancel events related to their books after mob-like discussions about the ethics of revisiting such an old case emerged on community Facebook pages. And there was apparently commentary coming from family members and like close family friends. So okay. There were actually reports of threats of violence or death against both authors.
Jeez.
For dredging the case up. So definitely a very protective community around Tony Costa. You know, meanwhile, we're a pretty new podcast. I think we got trolled for the first time recently in our Instagram DMs. So like, I don't think we're going to get enough attention for any sort of threats, but just wanted to like warn you guys. So I think it's interesting with the varying opinions.
I think it's hard because no matter what, the family of somebody that does something like this, they also experience trauma. And like having right. to deal with that and cope with that and grapple with the idea that you were married to a serial killer is probably pretty close to impossible.
I was going to say, you don't want to be reminded of that.
Exactly. I don't fault either of them for not wanting the case to be around anymore, because I'm sure it probably wasn't a very happy marriage to someone who had enough malice in him to commit crimes as disgusting as these. So yeah, I feel like it's also entirely possible that she was victimized by him in a few ways, and I don't blame her for not wanting to talk about it. It's just interesting that she could go from "it shouldn't be talked about unless it focuses on the victims" to "don't talk about it, it's disgusting."
I don't know. I feel like sometimes local like community members will attack the murderer's family members and blame them for what mm-hmm. happened. So I could totally understand how you would just want to live your life. Your life right. should not be tainted by what they did.
So all in all, these are some pretty horrific crimes. I didn't get into the nitty-gritty of it because I don't think that's the most interesting part. But I think they're certainly influenced by 60s heavy drug use and abuse, which I also didn't really get into, but I mentioned, you know, briefly that drugs played a role in this. And I just think the way this case still echoes through the community all these generations later is a really good example of a small town mystery.
Ooh, love the tie-in.
Yeah. And I've always wanted to end my segment on a zinger like that, and it happened so organically when I was writing. I'm so happy that worked out. But that's my segment. I think I thought it was going to be a lot shorter than it was, but there were a few tangents and whatnot, but very interesting discussion. So, yeah.
I think we need to come to the realization that nothing that we ever do is going to be short, because we all have big mouths. But Kate, thank you so much. That was awesome.
I had so much fun researching it, and it was really special to be researching it while I was down the Cape and in that environment. And just there's something about being on the Cape that's very quaint. Just itself feels like the entirety of the Cape is a big, small town. That sounds stupid to say out loud. Like, it's a big, small town, but like every single town on the Cape has small town vibes. So
right.
Really interesting to research a case and sort of dig into like the small town aspect of it. So,
All right. Thank you. Rachel, you're up next, right?
Yeah, Rach, let's do it.
All right. So last week we talked about underreported populations and missing white woman syndrome, how white women seem to get the most publicity when they're murdered.
Because there's disparities between minority groups about how cases are reported on, but it's negligible compared to the difference between white and non-white reporting. So,
and also women, to be honest.
Yeah, women. It's always the women. My mom and I were just talking about Gabby Petito today when you got we were listening to and it was talking about the missing white woman syndrome, and my mom was like, oh, Gabby Petito. And I was like, yeah, that's an example.
That's the first thing that came to my mind, honestly.
Everyone and their mother knew about that case while it was happening and knew about the manhunt and like knew. And so that's a really good example. But then there are these other cases that are equally as horrifying, if not more horrifying, that just fall by the wayside because they don't get the media attention. They don't get the clicks.
Yeah.
All right. So personally, I think that's fucked up. So I
agree.
Am covering the case of Maggie Long, a 17-year-old Asian Pacific high school senior who was found dead in her home. It was determined that Maggie Long was set on fire and ultimately was burned alive.
Oh, yeah. Oh my God.
I know. It's horrible. It's really horrible.
Okay.
All right. So let's get into it. So Maggie Long was born on December 17th, 1999. It's so weird because I could not find her birth year anywhere. But the thing is, she died on December 1st and her birthday is on December 17th. And she turned 18 that year. So that would be 1999, if I can do math.
Okay.
Maggie's parents were born in a Chinese community located in North Vietnam. During the Vietnam War, they fled to the U.S. So they lived in Colorado. So they owned several restaurants in the area, and they were well known in their local community, apparently. They owned 4 restaurants, which is a lot.
That's very impressive.
And I think she had 3 siblings. That's what I could find. Again, there's not a lot of information about it. It's kind of weird.
Okay.
So Maggie's sister, Connie, who plays a major role in my whole story and also is still super active in trying to get answers for Maggie. So she's 6 years older. And then they also had a sister named Lena, who was 31 at the time, so 14 years older, again, if I did the math correct. And then I also think she had a little brother.
Okay.
So Connie described Maggie as an overachiever. Maggie was a senior at Platte Canyon High School in Bailey, Colorado. She was a straight-A student. She was anticipated to graduate in the upcoming spring. Maggie was super involved in her community and in her high school environment. She participated in a lot of extracurricular activities, and she was always the first one to volunteer. In addition, Maggie was very passionate about acting and singing. She was super involved in theater, which I know relates personally to me and Kate because we met because freshman year play.
We did. We did the Wizard of Oz freshman year in high school. And I played one of the green flying monkeys in the Wizard of Oz.
Wonderful.
My face was painted green for all the shows. That's how Rachel met me. Literally painted green.
I don't even know. No, they're blue.
Wait, the monkeys are blue. I swear to God, I've seen the Wizard of Oz. The monkeys are blue.
I don't, that's honestly impressive because I don't even remember what I was. I was like some kind of like just part of the ensemble. Ensemble, how do you say?
Ensemble.
Ensemble. I was just part of the ensemble.
But I was also like specifically in a few like specific ensemble roles, and that's the one that I remember because it was me, and then all of the other flying monkeys were like first and second graders. So I was like in charge of the flying monkeys, and I used to help them do their homework backstage. Anyway, that's how Rachel and I met.
All I can think about is that picture of us where there's lipstick on my tooth. Like, yeah, I just, it's a burning image. All right. I'm sorry I had to share that with all of you. So back to Maggie, because she's what's important here. So, like, she was such a great person. Literally every year on her birthday, which was on December 17th, she would make hundreds of sandwiches and then pass them out to the homeless and less fortunate on the streets of Denver.
Oh,
yep. That is so nice.
I know. So Maggie would have turned 18 on December 17th. So literally 16 days after she was murdered, which is awful to even think about. So before we get into like what actually happened on the night of her murder, I just want to talk about her house. So the Long family lived in a 6,000 square foot ranch style home.
That's a big house.
I was going to say, damn.
Huge.
You're not even ready. I can like talk about it more at the end, but like I looked on Zillow and all this stuff.
It's crazy. I can imagine if it's 6,000 square feet.
It's 27 acres.
Whoa.
27 acres.
Yeah.
That is Colorado, but that's very big.
Yes.
It is Colorado.
So their address was 3763 County Road 43 in Bailey, Colorado. So just the driveway leading up to the house was a quarter mile long. Ugh. And I'm pretty sure there was some kind of gate like to get in just because I saw like pictures of that, but it just looked like a basic lock gate. Like it wasn't like anything crazy.
Right.
But I don't know. And then I also had to include this just because I feel like this is really strange. Some of the surrounding streets included Hangman's Road, Gunsmoke Drive, and Vigilante Avenue.
Is that real? That's wild.
I saw that somewhere. Maybe it's not real. Maybe I'm just like a sucker and I saw it.
That's ominous.
I don't know why someone would make that up. That's pretty crazy.
But also, who would want to live on Hangman's Road?
Yeah, right?
I would want nothing of that.
No.
Uh-uh. I believe you, but it's ominous.
Very.
You can't expect good things to happen when you live near Hangman's Road.
I agree. Vigilante All of those Avenue. Have, like, a weird vibe.
Yeah.
So their house was located 3 miles away from main roads. So just keep that in mind when we're talking about this case. So naturally, I looked this shit up on Google Maps. Because what else am I going to do? And like I said, I looked on Zillow, I looked on Redfin, and that's how I figured out it was 27 acres. Also, when you look at it, there's woods from every direction. So it is pretty secluded. So I think that's why, I do think that's why the people who committed this crime picked this house.
Yeah,
right.
So, on the night of December 1st, 2017, Maggie was supposed to work at the VIP lounge for a holiday concert at her high school. Connie, Maggie's sister, headed to the high school for the holiday concert. However, when she arrived, Maggie's friends questioned her about where Maggie was since she hadn't shown up to the VIP lounge like she was supposed to. All right, so here's a quote from Connie. My mom was working and she was stressed out. She's like, where's Maggie? I thought Maggie was going to come and work tonight. At the time, I was actually getting text messages from our tenant who lived in the upstairs unit of the house. And he was telling me that there was a lot of loud noises that he was hearing from downstairs.
That's not a good sign.
No, it is not.
So just some context. They were renting out, like, I think the attic or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they're actually the person who called 911.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah. So, worried about her sister, Connie called Maggie over and over again, but each time, right to voicemail.
Yep.
Maggie was a very responsible individual and would have never flaked on something important like this. Like, she signed up to be there. She was going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Connie immediately knew that something was not right, and she had a gut feeling in her stomach telling her to drive over to the family's house. Also, it's important to note that Connie didn't live with them. She lived on her own.
Okay.
Just thought I'd add that. Okay. Yeah. Connie said the closer she got to the house, the worse that feeling got in her stomach. She arrived at the house around 7:20 p.m. And once she, like, got close, she was able to see all the chaos going on. The house was clearly burned and was surrounded by fire trucks. But Maggie's car was still sitting in the driveway. So panicked, Connie immediately sprung into action, contacting friends, family, literally whoever she could get a hold of, posting on social media, trying to get some kind of information of where her sister was.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So this is tough. Like, I could not imagine being in this situation. But for the next 4 hours, Connie and her other family members were not allowed to enter the house, and they didn't get any information from the police. They had no idea what was going on. And around 11 p.m., the family was informed that the investigators had discovered a female body in the home, and they were also informed that the female body belonged to Maggie.
Wow.
I'm curious why Connie immediately jumped to her being missing and not her being in the house with her car there.
Well, there was a fire. They would have, the police were there, they would have found her.
But they didn't. So wouldn't you think that something had happened to her in the fire? I don't know.
The thing is, I don't really know what police told them. Do you know what I mean? Like, they were trying to figure out, they need to figure out what's going on before they're going to share any information at all.
Right.
Yeah, she probably was just doing whatever she could. Like, that's the only thing you can do, I guess.
I also think that denial is always the first stage.
Yeah, denial is not just a river in Egypt.
Oh,
let that one sink in.
But my question is, like, I don't know how they found out that it was her so fast if she was burned.
Maybe dental records.
Yeah, they still have ways of finding out who it was.
Where she was in the house, what she's wearing, stuff like that. Maybe, I don't know.
Could have been a necklace, a ring.
Yeah. She could have had, like, her license on her.
Yeah, I was gonna say
I don't know.
Yeah.
All right, so here is what the family kind of believed happened. So before going to work at the VIP lounge at her high school that evening, Maggie had stopped home to change her clothes and gather snacks that she had prepared specifically for this event. And she saw a white van and an old beat-up truck in the driveway. But she just must have assumed that these belonged to the tenant, because like I said, they were renting out the attic upstairs.
Right.
So Connie picked up Derek, their younger brother, from a friend's house after the concert and headed to their grandparents' house where they stayed for the night. Their other sister, Lena, was on her way back from Minnesota and arrived early the next morning. It took 4 days for the Long family to be able to go back inside of their home and find out greater detail about the fire.
Yikes.
They were toured around by the sheriff department and were shown areas of damage in the house. There was also damage in the garage, and that's important because that indicates that the perpetrators attempted to set multiple points of fire around the whole entire house. So they were
okay.
They were clearly trying to cover something up.
Yeah.
So the investigation. A lot of people were not very happy about how they handled this, which I feel like is not out of the normal. But so following the fire, there was a gag order put in place. The police finally came forward with an official statement a week after. In January of 2019, the Park County Sheriff's Office, Colorado Bureau of Investigation, FBI, and Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives made a statement. They theorized that Maggie walked into an active burglary at her family's home.
Okay.
In this press conference, they reported that the night of the fire at around 7 p.m., police had received a 911 call that people were inside the Long home and were causing damage. And apparently they're being loud. And there was at least one male at the crime scene at the time. So it was very clear that a physical altercation had taken place in the house before the fire was set. The suspects stole a Beretta handgun, an AK-47 style rifle, 2,000 rounds of ammunition, a green safe, and jade figurines.
Ooh.
So there was definitely some kind of robbery involved. Obviously, they took stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The community was completely outraged. They had to wait that long to even find out the truth, which I don't blame them. But at the same time, I feel like you want to get all your ducks in a row before you make any kind of statement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I saw this on one source. I tried to find if this was legitimate or not. I don't know. Again, she was 17, so she was a minor.
Mm-hmm.
I did see somewhere that she fought the robbers and they were able to overtake her and tie her to a bed. And it's speculated that she was sexually assaulted, which I'm hoping that's not the case. I'm really hoping.
Yeah, that's just horrific to think about.
So the El Paso County Coroner's Office ruled Maggie's tragic death as a homicide. Authorities released three composite sketches of three different men that were believed to be connected to Maggie's murder. Police believe that the assailants were driving a late 1990s to 2000s light-colored Chevy Astro van and a Ford pickup. The thing is, I just want to note, like, multiple vehicles? That is so sketchy.
That is interesting.
I know. Connie's sister told Dateline that there was no way that Maggie knew her attackers. And here's a quote from Connie. "There's no way that anyone who knew my sister would do something so horrific to her. She was in the wrong place at the wrong time."
Mm.
So things get a little bit different in May of 2021, 3.5 years after Maggie was murdered. The FBI comes forward and announces that they're now going to be investigating this Asian American teenager's murder as a hate crime.
Oh,
interesting.
I don't really know how they got to this.
Yeah.
I saw in multiple places too that when you announce that it's a hate crime, you get way more resources to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that played a role in it or not. I have no idea. Obviously, I'm not one to say.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've done work on hate crime classification and procedures with police departments before. And the criteria for determining whether something's a hate crime varies so much by state, and even within the states, varies within the individual towns. Like, there's no set criteria for what constitutes a hate crime. So it could have been.
The family was surprised by this reclassification of the crime. The family had never noted any discrimination or hate towards the Asian population. I think it's also important to note that the Long family was one of few Asian families in the community at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. I think that's another reason why a hate crime could be a possible thing.
Makes sense. Mm-hmm.
So the real question here is this a hate crime? Or was it a robbery and Maggie was just in the wrong place at the wrong time? The executive director of the Asian Pacific Development Center, which is a nonprofit organization located in Aurora, has addressed Maggie's murder. The mission of this organization is to help Asian immigrants settle in Colorado. So he said, hate crimes is not something that is new for the Asian community. It has existed well before 2016 and is certainly still happening right now. Hate crimes against Asian people are not uncommon, but it's vague as to whether it was the case here. It's difficult to know whether what happened to Maggie was a hate crime because we do not know the details.
Mm-hmm.
Fair.
He also said that there's been a spike in hate crimes against Asians around the world, which I know we are all aware of.
Yeah.
One of which happened in 2016, which was around the time of the U.S. presidential election, which was a crazy time.
Mm-hmm.
And then another time in 2020, which I'm sure you hear 2020 and you ultimately know where I'm going. The Asian population was blamed for COVID because it originated in China, which is like absolutely horrible. All right, so where is Maggie's investigation now? Currently, her case is being handled by a 5-person task force, which consists of the FBI, Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and the Park County Sheriff's Office. So the tough thing here is that these are not the original people who are on the case. Some officials have either moved on or retired. However, they do report that they are still actively investigating Maggie's murder, and they do have leads that they are following up on. The Long sisters have come forward saying that they are not in regular contact with the task force, and they have no idea what's really going on with Maggie's investigation. But the thing is, that's not necessarily abnormal. I feel like the police don't tell everyone everything, especially even the family, which is sucks, but.
Yeah, I've seen that in a number of the cases that I've researched.
As mentioned earlier, the investigators on this case have switched around a good amount, which rightly so has led the Long family to feel frustrated because they feel like it's just switching between person to person to person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now let's get on to Maggie's memory and Maggie's friends and family. Like I said, this is going to make you cry.
Cool. Lay it on me.
So Maggie's memory remains alive in her local community. Like I said earlier, Maggie really enjoyed being in theater. She used to perform at the Venue Theater in Conifer, Colorado. And in her memory, the theater honored her with a scholarship fund and a seat plaque with her name on it.
Hmm.
This part really gets to me. So here's a quote from her sister, Connie. It's a seat she would always sit in. She loved being in the theater. And now you can see her legacy lives on here in the place she loved.
Oh.
I know. Chills. Her memory also lives on at her high school. So she went to a really small high school. Like, I'm talking a total of 300 people.
That's, like, the size of our entire graduating class.
Yeah, that was.
Yeah, I know. Very, very small. So obviously everybody knows everyone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So Maggie's softball jersey with number 30 printed on it is framed and is currently sitting in the office of Principal Mike Schmidt, who is in the process of trying to figure out where to put it permanently, because obviously that's what Maggie deserves. There were also pictures of Maggie hanging up on the walls around her high school. And then some of Maggie's loved ones even got elephant tattoos in her honor, because Maggie loved to collect, like, small elephant trinkets.
Aww.
So remember how I said that Maggie was a super great person and that on her birthday, she would go out and hand out sandwiches to the homeless. Well, 2 weeks after her murder, like I said, she was supposed to turn 18. So her friends wanted to keep the tradition alive, and they themselves made sandwiches and then went and handed them out to the homeless.
Oh my God. That's very sweet.
I know. I love that. So more than 4 years later, her family and friends still grieve for the loss of Maggie and beg for answers. After Maggie's death, the Long family made the decision to sell their home in Bailey and relocate to Denver. What happened to the Long family was so traumatic that the family was unable to step back in the house after that night, which I don't blame them. I don't think I could do either. No, of course not. So in their new house in Denver, they have a room that's just dedicated to Maggie's memory and is dedicated with items that they were able to salvage from the fire.
Oh my God.
I hope they were at least able to salvage important items. That's what you can hope for.
Yeah.
So Maggie was a senior. So in June, she was supposed to graduate. So of course, she couldn't walk. She wasn't there. So Connie walked for her and accepted her diploma because Maggie's life was cut too short.
That must have been very emotional for her, for Connie.
I can't imagine.
That would have been super emotional. I would even imagine being in the audience.
Oh, I would just cry being in the audience.
Yep.
So for everyone that loved Maggie, it's really important that her memory is never forgotten. So for the past 4 years, every December, Maggie's friends and family gather together on her birthday to remember and celebrate her ambitious spirit, her positive attitude, and her contagious laugh. Connie told Dateline that when we're with friends and we're all together, we feel Maggie's vibe, and it's like we're with Maggie. Connie also said that every year on her anniversary, she goes through Maggie's personal belongings. And here's a quote from Connie. "I opened up her computer and I found a note that she wrote to herself for when she turns 18. The main message that she was giving herself was, no matter what you decide to do with your life, just be a good person."
Oh, that's beautiful.
So now we're going to dive into some completely, like, nutty theories. I really don't think there's a lot of actual substance to these theories. But literally right before we were going to record, I decided to hop on Web Sleuth, and I found so much shit, which absolutely blew me away. So again, I don't know how really accurate this is. So some people claimed that the Long family was running a gambling place out of their home, which I don't know anything about that, but at the same time, I feel like that's stereotyping.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like that.
Microaggression, victim blaming.
Yeah.
Racism.
Like, do they have any evidence for this?
All I was able to find was this was posted on Web Sleuth. Apparently it was deleted, and there's a Facebook group, and the person who runs the Facebook group had seen that, so they were able to, like, put it there. But I read through the comments, because obviously I had to. And people are like, "I've been living here my whole life, like, I've never heard that, blah, blah, blah."
Yeah.
So again, I don't think there's a lot of substance to these, and you're going to understand, especially after this next one, that they also believe that the Chinese mob was involved.
Mm.
Which, again, is, like, stereotyping.
Yeah, that's... yeah.
But I did find this one thing that was absolutely insane. And some people argue that there's a connection, but I don't really understand what the connection would be. But maybe you can tell me. So, in 2006, Maggie's sister, Lena, who was the 31-year-old, who I think was 14 years older than Maggie, went to the same high school as Maggie did. On September 27th, 2006, when she was in school, a 53-year-old man by the name of Dwayne Roger Morrison entered the school claiming that he was armed with a bomb. He took 6 female students hostage and sexually assaulted all of them.
Oh,
you know.
It's horrible.
Lena being one of them. So when police entered the school, Morrison opened fire, and he shot Emily Keyes in the head, killing her. But everybody else came out okay. All the other hostages were safe, and Morrison ended up committing suicide. So I don't really know how those two things would be related, but I just think it's weird that so many horrible things happened to this poor family.
It's a lot of tragedy for one family.
I know.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I know you hate this word, Rachel, but it's a coincidence that they would have two family members involved in such horrific things, but presumably.
It happens.
presumably not connected.
So the FBI and the Long family are offering a reward for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the people responsible for Maggie's murder. This reward was recently increased to $75,000. Anyone with information about Maggie's case is asked to call the Maggie Long Task Force at 303-239-4243 or the FBI Denver at 1-800-CALL-FBI or submit tips online at fbi.gov/tips. And just remember, no tip is ever too small.
Yeah. Unless it's a false one. We don't want any of those.
Yeah, and unless it's a false tip, in which case it's way too small and you should not submit it.
Yeah, don't do that.
But even if, like, you're pondering, being like, oh, I don't know if this is relevant or not, just submit it.
Well, yeah.
Right, because you never know what could end up being helpful to the investigation. You never know exactly where they are in the investigation and what they're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the thing is, too, is the general population doesn't really know what's going on with the investigation. So you might as well just get them anything you can. So, yep, there's the horrible case of Maggie Long. I really hope that someday they're able to figure out what happened to this poor girl.
Yeah, that was crazy. She must have been just so scared in that situation. I feel just so horribly for her family.
I don't know. Based on, like, everything I researched, I do feel like I don't know. I think it was, like, a robbery, and I think she was just kind of there at the wrong time. But I don't know. Yeah. I don't know if her Asian descent could have been involved. Like, maybe they were just going to target, like, that Asian household that lived here. Who knows?
Right.
Just horrible.
Well, thank you for covering that one, Rachel.
You're so welcome.
Yeah, that was a tough case to listen to, but very interesting, nonetheless. So thanks for tuning in, and thanks you guys for all the research you put in. This was a great episode. I'm looking forward to what Christine has to talk about next week. I'm sure it'll be really amazing. So thanks for tuning in. Bye.
Thank you. Bye, guys.
Thank you so much for tuning in.